Hi, my name is Dave Page, and I'm one of the board members for the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum, and I'm very pleased to be here today with...
Dr. Tom Ofterheide. I'm a professor of emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Dr. R.J. Frasconi. I'm a medical director of Regents Hospital Emergency Medical Services and associate professor of emergency medicine at the University of Minnesota.
We are really lucky here today to be able to talk to some of the study authors directly. So oftentimes on the PCRF podcasts, we have our gaggle of geeks just kind of talking about research and articles and studies that we had nothing to do with. And it's really special to be able to be talking to people who are doing cardiac arrest research and publishing it. So we're going to talk about two different studies or two parts of the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium studies, the ROC trials. One of them was in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it's September 2011, volume 365. It's the early versus later rhythm analysis in patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Ian Steele is the lead author in that particular paper. And then we're also going to talk about another paper that also appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine. The title is A Trial of an Impedance Threshold Device in Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, the ITD. So with that introduction, instead of our usual discussion of the abstract, which in this case, because we have the authors, I'm just going to turn it over to them to discuss each one of them. So take it away.
Well, sure. Thank you. I was fortunate to be head author of the impedance threshold device study. This is actually a factorial study design, and by that I mean that both of these trials were done simultaneously. It's possible to do that kind of a study if you believe that the interventions will not affect each other. And statistically, you have the power to be able to have a reasonable power to come to the study conclusion. And in this case, with the earlier analyze, later study, and the impedance threshold device, it was felt that they both could be done simultaneously. And so they were. The early versus later rhythm analysis paper is based on the unknown when we started the study of whether what degree of chest compressions was most appropriate prior to analyzing the patient's first rhythm. We felt at the time that no CPR prior to analyzing the patient's rhythm was probably not ethical because most EMS systems around the country provided some CPR. And so the two major groups for this study were 30 seconds versus 3 minutes of CPR prior to rhythm analysis. The physiology behind this is to provide improved coronary blood flow to the heart prior to defibrillation, and that with greater blood flow to the heart before defibrillation, the greater success, and therefore the greater survival rate. So that was the physiology and the purpose of that trial. The second trial, the impedance threshold device trial, is a prospective, randomized, double-blind, controlled clinical evaluation of the impedance threshold device in patients with cardiac arrest. All patients with all rhythms, including ventricular fibrillation, EMD, and asystole, were entered actually in both trials. And all patients were adults, at least 18 years of age or age of consent, since the study was done both in the United States and Canada. The purpose of the impedance threshold device trial was to determine whether or not survival to hospital discharge with good neurologic function, defined as a modified Rankine score of less than or equal to 3, occurred with the use of an active versus sham ITD.
Fascinating. So Large trials. How many services participated? How many people needed to be trained?
Well, there were there are 10 study sites in North America, three in Canada and seven in the United States that participated in this study. Number of EMS systems was huge. I believe it was in the range of 200.
Right.
And there were literally thousands and thousands of EMS providers.
So logistically, it just becomes really difficult to get this many people on board with the same process, right?
Well, it is truly remarkable that these studies could actually be performed at all. The purpose of the Resuscitation Outcomes Consortium is to do just that, to be able to accomplish large clinical trials in a reasonably short period of time, to answer important clinical questions and research questions, and therefore advance the field and move the field forward. ROC is designed to be able to do that, and these were really the first cardiac arrest prospective studies coming from that group.
So looking at it today now, RJ, when I'm training paramedics, the early versus later defibrillation one is pretty clear. In VFib, shock them right away. In PEA systole, wait, do a few do interventions and definitely later shocks, or if appropriate, later shocks are better. But that's not AHA today. That's not ACLS today. Would you say if somebody's listening out there, they can and should shock right when if they see VFib?
Well, Tom, I think that's a question for you to answer.
Okay.
It's your study.
Well, it's a good question because it's relatively ambiguous. But the take-home message from the Analyze Early Later study is that we found no statistically significant benefit of either early, that is 30 seconds, versus 3 minutes of CPR. We actually did cubic spline analysis looking at the benefit with time as a continuous variable. And there looked to be fairly equivalent benefit around and up to including 2 minutes of CPR. So I would say that if you are at a witnessed arrest, of course, that's VF shock and shock immediately. If the downtime is short, shock. And then all of those wonderful EMS directors around the country have the option of choosing their what they feel is the optimal time period before defibrillation or rhythm analysis. It probably should be less than 2 minutes, or up to and including 2 minutes.
Good. Let's get to the ITD. You both were involved in the we did an earlier podcast on ITD and ACD, active compression decompression CPR, that had great results. It came out in the January edition of GEMS and was published subsequently, right in January, I believe, in Lancet. So great outcomes on that, and made me quite a believer in an ITD. Now I read the headline from the ROC trial and think, uh-oh, no difference with the ITD. And so let's get into some of the mechanics of how it is that this large trial could come up with an ITD result that says pretty much no difference. Because there were some differences in application and length of time, downtime. So how again, it's the headline. So what do you think?
Well, I think Dr. Arfzahidi sort of referred to the multifactorial or the factorial nature of this trial, which means that, as you pointed out, this large, complicated construct of a research model had to be further complicated by trying to study two things at once. it was almost an insurmountable task for Rock to do that. And I think my personal feeling is that the data shows that the ITD suffered because of that. Primarily, again, what you were referring to, which had to do with delay to application of the device. It appears to me that we're talking in terms of 10 to 15 minutes, depending on how you look at the data.
Before the ITD got placed.
Yes, and that has to do somewhat with the timing of the trial as well. It was timed a little bit differently than the rescue trial was. The problem with that, of course, is we could have told them that the ITD does not work with that sort of time delay. We had essentially no survivors with that kind of time delay in our own trial. The time to application of the ITD in the rescue trial was on average 34 seconds. This was clearly being utilized as a BLS device, and not necessarily was it being used as a BLS device now, in the ROC study.
So what was it? But the protocol in ROC was for the BLS crews to put it on. Is that just we didn't follow the protocol and we didn't put it on? Is that because let's face it, EMTs and paramedics may or may not be believers in the device. So if you don't really think that the device is going to make a difference and it's just kind of another thing that you need to do, maybe you just choose not to do it.
It was a complicated protocol, and I think that's the nature of the issue. But I'm going to let Tom speak more specifically to it.
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that the rescue trial was a different study in that it used active compression decompression CPR or suction cup CPR and the impedance threshold device and compared it with standard CPR. As you referred to, it was a very positive study. There was a 53% improvement in survival to hospital discharge with a good neurologic function defined as MRS less than or equal to 3. The ROC study is different in that it used standard CPR with the impedance threshold device, with a sham or active impedance threshold device. And one of the first questions, if you're asking, and I think you are, why is ROC a neutral study and why is the rescue trial a positive study? There's a laundry list of potential reasons. One is simply that with active compression, decompression, or suction cup CPR, you always achieve complete chest wall recoil. And therefore, you achieve the physiology that you're after, which is suction on the upstroke of CPR every single time. With standard CPR, the amount of suction that's generated in the chest is dependent on the elastic recoil of the chest. And as we all know, elderly patients, for example, don't have the elasticity in the chest. And so there might be more variable achievement of suction on the upstroke of CPR with standard CPR compared with active compression, decompression CPR. There are other reasons why one could speculate why the ROC study was neutral. As RJ has pointed out, it was a complex a clinical trial. It was two studies at once. The EMS providers have to provide high-quality clinical care first, and then a very, this turned out, a relatively complex study protocol. As was referred to, the device was placed late, around an average of 13 minutes from dispatch to actual application on the patient. And as we know, there's a three-phase model of cardiac arrest: the electrical phase, which is about the first 4 minutes, the hemodynamic phase up to 4 to 10 minutes, and then you get into the metabolic phase after 10 minutes. Well, of course, treatment is different for those different phases. You want to apply electricity and defibrillation in the first 4 minutes. You want to improve hemodynamics from 4 to 10 minutes. And I don't think we're real sure what's optimal for the metabolic phase when you get into advanced life support yet, but clearly a good perfusion throughout from the beginning to the end is optimal. We found in the rescue trial that the sooner CPR was started and the sooner the devices were applied, the better the survival rate was, and that it was a time-dependent effect. And so one could speculate that the late placement of the device in terms of the ROC study may have also contributed to the neutral findings. I take away in conglomerate from the rescue trial and from these two ROC trials that CPR, initiation of CPR and initiation of good hemodynamics is time dependent. It is like early defibrillation, and that early CPR needs to occur if we want to maximize outcome from our patients in cardiac arrest.
I think that it is very important to understand that these are two different trials. They were studying different things. Also, what we're talking about right now is the general, how can I say this? It's the main endpoint analyses that we're talking about as the paper came out in the New England Journal. Hopefully, there'll be future papers looking at subsetting some of this data. We already have an abstract that was presented at the American Heart Association regarding the quality of CPR during the ROC trial. And I think we're going to glean something very, very important from that, which basically says that there was a very high percentage CPRs that were being done at outside of the rate parameters that are acceptable rate parameters. Many of the cases were done.
The rates and the compression depths are consistent, then maybe the benefit of that device becomes a little bit more interesting.
Right. The CPR was monitored during the ROC study, so it's a piece of that trial that can be very valuable is to look at what we actually are doing in the field, and then of course to subset that data to see how those patients did. Who got the ITD, who were getting CPR done correctly. Tom had a previous trial. It was published, I think, in Circulation 2004 with the ITD. And without that study, we wouldn't have known that the excellent paramedics in Milwaukee were actually hyperventilating patients to some very serious levels. We had, I think, as I recall, we had an average of 37, and we brought them all back, and the average was then 22, still very, very dangerous.
Yeah. It was a fantastic study, a landmark study.
Right, and it was that led to correction of that problem. And I think that the ROC could provide that as well by analyzing data and seeing what we need to do to correct the problem.
I think, you need to be commended for that study, just because I think hyperventilation has been sort of a epidemic in our patient care, and Milwaukee took the hit, but we all are equally responsible across this country for
doing
that.
There's no question every medic and physician and RT in the country was probably doing that.
And we see it continuously. We bring patients in and they're being hyperventilated. So.
Myself included, by the way. So I stopped doing that after I looked at the data for the first time. But we learned something extremely important way back then, and that is that the quality of CPR really matters. And it is CPR is complex. The hemodynamically significant components of CPR include ventilation rate and duration, depth of compression, rate of compression, and hands-on time, at least. And I think we're going to find, as these are the first two papers from ROC, but we're going to be doing post hoc analyses, looking at quality of CPR and how the ITD fared, the sham and active valve fared with different types of CPR and different qualities of CPR. And I think we may learn more from these post hoc analyses than we have learned now with conglomerate data.
Yeah. I mean, when I look at this, it's hard for me to go around the country and talk about, because I'm a fan of the ITD. And just for the record, no one at the table on this podcast is getting any financial support from this company whatsoever. So we have no stake in it. It's really been more of a scientific and patient care oriented endeavor for everyone on the microphone. And I think that the when we sit and look at whether this thing works or not, there's just some complicating factors. People are very skeptical, and then they say, you know, and I think I read in your paper that some of the paramedics didn't take it off once we had ROSC. And so, you know, if it's working before, maybe it'll work while we have ROSC. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of the device. So if it's not being used appropriately, then, you know, maybe it didn't work as well. And I think that probably, that again, it's the fine print. So if you read the abstract and the headline, you may not get the whole story.
Sure. And every, as we all know, if you've seen one EMS system, you've seen one EMS system. And so ROC is no different. And the participating centers are all different. Some had great difficulty in having their basic life support providers actually participate. And so those centers had ALS only. And so what started off as a primary BLS, and yes, that's the way the protocol was written, its actual implementation was different due to the practical barriers that occurred due to the differences in EMS systems. And that type of confounding, that can be also be a potential confounder to the outcome.
I think what the listeners should glean from this is that in these large clinical trials, large trials period, the devil is in the details, and it's difficult to write all those details, you know, in 2,500 words. Also, the other thing is that you have a primary data point, secondary data points, and that's generally what's discussed in the initial paper, but it's not at all uncommon that these trials will produce many papers with post hoc analysis and subset analyses. The rescue trial has done the same thing. And sometimes those papers are even more interesting than the original paper and more meaningful.
I think it's interesting, too, in cardiac arrest research, which seems to be really prevalent and popular in our profession, and we wish that everybody listening will do more research. You would want to try and limit the number of variables being studied so that you don't have different therapies being applied at different points and different interventions that we know may or may not make a difference. And so things like having two different variables, whether it's, you know, ITD use and then active compression, decompression, that's two different variables that were studied in the rescue trial. In this case, we may have had a multitude of other variables that we know do or don't make a difference, i.e. therapeutic hypothermia, i.e. a team-based approach to resuscitation, perhaps following the ACLS protocols in terms of use of epinephrine or not. And so, as you've said, RJ, you know, it may be time to redo some of the old studies that we thought didn't matter, now that we know that some of these things do matter, because they may no longer be valid. Some of the things we thought didn't matter, you know, now with better compressions might.
Sure. And you can add quality of CPR to that list, as well as protocol adherence to study protocol, application of the device early versus late. I think we have a multitude of data, again, in post hoc analyses that are going to be very informative.
Yeah, drug therapies, surgical approaches. I think that we are in an extremely exciting period of time for resuscitation research, and that it seems like every year we're making more progress than we did in the previous 40, and I think it's going to continue over the next 5 years.
So oftentimes in these podcasts, we talk about how the people either doing the study or the people that are involved in the study can wreck it by, you know, if we're doing a placebo drug, we taste it to figure out, well, which one is going to be given. So in this case, can you talk a little bit about the blinding? The paramedics were blinded to the whether or not the ITD was a sham or not. So, and for people who don't know the term, the sham ITD, meaning the ITD that wasn't doing anything versus the ITD that was doing something. Could they really tell the difference between the one that was and the wasn't that wasn't?
That was a good question. And actually, people within ROC, when we first started this study, just peppered me with that question, where whenever I walk down the hall, hey, can you tell the difference between these two? So, and it's important to know and to understand before to assure that, in fact, you do have a double-blind trial. First of all, the sham acts simply as a hollow conduit. So there is no impedance, and it does not obstruct airflow either in or out of the chest, whereas the active device will occlude the airway on the upstroke of CPR, thereby creating or augmenting the negative intrathoracic pressure, facilitating venous blood return and improving forward blood flow to both the heart and brain as a result. So the devices actually are not, it is impossible to tell the difference between the two. For this study, they were made with opaque plastic, so you could not see inside of them. They were placed in a sealed plastic bag. That bag, if it was broken, if the seal was broken, device needed to be taken out immediately. Out of the system and replaced with another randomized device. Theoretically, a paramedic could open up the bag, put their mouth to the device,
suck on the device,
determine whether there was impedance or not, put it back into the plastic bag, seal it with some heat in such a way that no one could tell that they were in, and then be present at the next time it was used and determine what the device was actually randomized to. We felt at the end of the day that was so far-fetched that this was a truly randomized,
you'd need
blinded
a conspiracy.
Trial.
You'd need the whole crew to be in on it and, you know, do a little test on one, a taste test, and then do the next one and do a taste test.
That's right.
Oh, good.
So it was truly a double-blinded trial.
Great. Good. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I think this is really great, and you are doing such great work in resuscitation. You should both be commended about how this is going. And I'm always amazed at how cardiac resuscitation is more and more turning into neurological resuscitation. So where we thought we were dealing with cardiology, we're also dealing with neurology and brains and saving brains. And it seems like some of that low flow state or the active decompression of the chest may help us circulate more blood, decrease cerebral perfusion, or increase cerebral perfusion by decreasing intracranial pressure. And clearly the work you're doing is in that area. So,
well, thanks for bringing that up. I think it's absolutely critical. We can't be in the business of improving survival from cardiac arrest. We need to be in the business of improving neurologically intact survival from cardiac arrest. And this physiology is a unique physiology that I think achieves the potential to achieve that on a regular basis, because as soon as there is suction within the chest or augmented negative pressure on the upstroke of CPR, intracranial pressure is instantly reduced and reduced significantly. And so you've really done two things with this physiology. First, bring more blood back up to the chest on the upstroke and more blood going out on the downstroke while simultaneously reducing intracranial pressure and thereby significantly improving perfusion to the brain. And in the rescue trial, that's exactly what we saw. We saw not only an improvement in survival, but an improvement in survival with good neurological outcome.
And it turns out that the cardiac arrest insult is much greater to the brain than it is to the myocardium. And one of the things that we gleaned from the rescue trial is not only how important that is, but also the fact that it takes the brain a lot longer to recover than it does the myocardium. And it's one of the things we're trying to look at now to see what the parameters of that recovery period is. It's not at all clear. We're pretty certain that we've been turning people off too early.
Yeah.
How early that is, I don't know. We had survivors up to 90 days in the rescue trial. So there's a lot more work to be done.
Yeah, it was interesting. We did in GEMS put in a recent abstract regarding snappy CPR and the use of nitroprusside in and perhaps even abdominal binding and just the concepts of reperfusion and higher pressures with the high pressure, low pressure, trying to open things up so that we'd have better perfusion. And all of those things, bring us back to maybe even why therapeutic hypothermia works because of reperfusion injury to the brain later on and its neuroprotective mechanism. And maybe earlier neuroprotective mechanisms could work out if we could do something different.
Well, as RJ said, it is a fascinating time for cardiac arrest research and resuscitation research. And I think over the next 5 years, you're going to be busy reporting some really stunning improvements and advancements in this field. So thank you very much for your interest.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for coming. Thanks for tuning in for another edition of the PCRF Podcasts.